ॐ नमो भगवते
वासुदेवाय
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय मुखं करोति वाचलं भङ्गं लङ्गायते गिरिं यत्कृपतरहं वन्दे श्रीगुरुं दीनतारिणम्. So we're continuing with the study of Srimad Bhagavatam as the natural commentary of Vedanta Sutra. So today's session, March 25, is dedicated at examining how the Srimad Bhagavatam explains perception and illusion. These are very important considerations in philosophy. So as we mentioned in the last refutation of the Buddhist philosophy, how one school, the third school called Yogacara, has a view which is very common. That view is called subjective idealism. Another term for the same thing is solipsism. This word solipsism, the root is the Latin word solus. From this word we get our English word soul, not S-O-U-L, meaning the spirit soul, but S-O-L-E, meaning to be alone. When you are the sole person in a room, that means you're the only person in the room. So there is a philosophy called solipsism, or otherwise subjective idealism, which means that the idea is that I am the only conscious being in existence. And everyone else, all other beings, are product of my imagination or my perception. So that's the philosophy of this Yogacara form of Buddhism. That is also the philosophy, ultimately the philosophy of the Mayavadis, who say, Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman. But what is this Brahman? Eka Brahma Dvitiya Nashti. There is only one Brahma, only one being, one conscious being. Eka Brahma, Dvitiya Nashti, there is no one else. So the Mayavadi philosophers, in other words, they're understanding themselves to be Brahman. I alone am Brahman. Everything else and everyone else that I perceive is my Maya, my illusion. And so the goal of Mayavadi philosophy is to realize the pure self without illusion. And that self is one. That's me. You are me. I am you. That's how it goes. We're all one. And ultimately, this philosophy of solipsism, it is a philosophy of all materialists. You'll find in Srila Prabhupada's books a statement quoted, Sanskrit statement, Atmavan manyate jagat, which means that the conditioned soul thinks that the jagat, the universe, is as he perceives it or as he believes it to be. You see? He thinks the way he sees things, that's reality, in other words. So, reality is based on my perception, in other words. As I understand things, that's the reality. So this is just another form of the same solipsism. The same idea of thinking I'm the only conscious being. This is the result of pride. And pride is a qualification for falling down into the material world. To come to this material world, we have to be puffed up. And in this puffed up condition, we think, I'm number one, I'm the center, I'm the most important. Therefore, the way I see things, that is all in all. So there's a story from Bengal to illustrate this. Funny story. Story of a Englishman. Because as you know, not so long ago, India was a colony of Great Britain. So the English came here to make business. Of course, to run the government, but also to make business. And some Englishmen, they were running plantations. Great fruit farms and vegetable farms and so on. So, one Englishman, he was running a big fruit orchard. He had groves of different kinds of fruit trees. He was growing these fruits and harvesting them and selling them back in England. So, there was a custom that he would award as a giving gift to his workers. He would give them fruits, and they would... Actually, there's a custom that his workers would offer him fruits when they would, especially when they would want something from him. They would offer him fruits. So, one man, he wanted to have some time off, actually because his father died. So he wanted to go to the village of his father and conduct the funeral. So for this, he needed a week or so off of work. So in order to do this, he brought his boss, the Englishman, a jackfruit. Now a jackfruit is a special kind of fruit. The ripe jackfruit, the inside of it, is like dough, like what they call attar, like very sticky dough. So, normally you cannot eat this fruit, just eat it, it has to be cooked. But the Englishman didn't know that, he wasn't aware of jackfruit. He was aware of mango, he was aware of papaya, so many other fruits. But jackfruit is not known to Western people, so he did not have any. But he was very proud, thinking, I'm a, what do they call, fruiterer or whatever it is. I'm a fruit grower. So I cannot let this Bengali, this native, as they used to call them, I cannot let this native think that I don't know what kind of fruit this is. So he accepted the fruit. Now the thing was, is this Englishman, he had a very nice beard. And he was very proud of his beard. His beard was very luxuriant and nicely trimmed. So, he accepted the jackfruit, and then the man said, his worker said, "So, my lord, I need 1 week off, 1 week leave." And the Englishman thought, well, he gave me this nice big fruit. All right, so you can take your week off. So then the Englishman, he brought his fruit into the house and he thought, well, let me see what this fruit tastes like. So he cut it open and he began to eat it. Now the thing was, because the inside of a fresh jackfruit is like dough. So it went all in his beard and stuck his beard all together. And once that happens, there's no way to get it out. You can wash. The beard was all stuck together, stringy, and looked very terrible. So the Englishman was very embarrassed. And what could he do? Finally, there was nothing else to do except shave off his beard. In the meantime, the worker had asked for 1 week off, had gone to the village of his father and performed a funeral sacrifice, burning the body. Now when one does this traditionally in India, one has to shave the head. So this man shaved his head. And so he came back to work after a week with a shaved head, and he met his boss, the Englishman, who now had a shaved face. And the Englishman saw him with a shaved head. He was surprised. And he said, "Oh, did you put your whole head in a jackfruit?" So this is an example of Atmavan Manyate Jagat. Because one is puffed up, one thinks he can understand everyone and everything from his own point of view. And of course, when this comes to spiritual subject matter, then it's ludicrous. Because we are now in material consciousness. So it's ludicrous, it is dangerous to try to, on the basis of our material perception, propose what is spiritual life, or who is a spiritual personality, what his level of realization is, and so on. Just like there's another story, a story of a man who had a parrot. He was keeping a pet parrot in a cage, and this parrot was very clever and very naughty. So what this parrot would do, because the parrot could perfectly imitate the voice of the owner, he would reach with his leg through the cage and pick up the telephone, and he would dial the phone and call up pizza places and order pizza, or he would order flowers, order other things. So the man would come home and he would see on his doorstep there was pizza, there were flowers, and he has to pay for them. So he'd become very angry with the parrot. But somehow or other, because these were just little things, he didn't become too angry. But he would chastise the parrot, "You rascal bird, don't do this." But the parrot was very clever. He would always find a way. So one day, in the blazing hot of summer, the parrot picked up the telephone and called the heating oil company and said, "Please deliver 1,000 liters of heating oil." So the man came home from work and he saw this big tank truck in front of his house, and they just finished pumping 1,000 liters into his furnace tank. And he said, "What are you doing?" "Well, sir, you called us. We've just delivered your 1,000 liters. I have to pay for 1,000 liters of oil, and it's summertime. What is this nonsense?" "Oh, it's that damn parrot again." This time he was very angry, because now it's very expensive. So in great fury, he ran in, he opened the cage, he grabbed the parrot, and he put the parrot against the wall and hammered the wings into the wall, and hammered also a nail through both feet. So the parrot was hanging with nailed wings and nailed feet, and he was in great agony. And in his great pain, the parrot suddenly saw the vision of Lord Jesus Christ on the crucifix. And the parrot said to Jesus, "Oh, I'm in such pain hanging here on nails. It is horrible." And Jesus said, "I've been hanging like that for 2,000 years. And the parrot said, "Oh, how much oil did you order?" So this is another illustration. Atmavan Manyate Jagat. Based on material experience, we cannot understand the position of transcendental personalities, the transcendental world. But yet, foolish living entities, they try. So now, we want to hear the Srimad Bhagavatam's explanation of perception. How do we perceive? Because these different philosophers, they're actually thinking perception depends completely on myself alone. Or even perception is just a product of my own mind. The whole world is just a creation of my mind. So let us hear from Srimad Bhagavatam, 11th canto, chapter 22, texts 30 through 32. Here is the Bhagavata explanation of perception. My dear Uddhava, my material energy, comprising three modes and acting through them, manifests the varieties of creation along with varieties of consciousness for perceiving these varieties of creation. The manifest result of material transformation is understood in three aspects: adhyatmic, adidaivik, and adibhautik. So, the next verse, 31. Sight, visible form, and the reflected image of the sun within the aperture of the eye all work together to reveal one another. Now we'll just look at the word for word so we can understand that the function of sight, the power of sight, that is adhyatma. The rupa, the visible form of the sun, that form that we see, is the adibhuta, the object. And the image of the sun that comes into the eye, the image of the sun in the sky that comes into the eye, that is adidaiva. Because that's obvious. Daiva means demigod, so the sun is a demigod. So to continue with this verse, Sight, visible form, and the reflected image of the sun within the aperture of the eye all work together to reveal one another. But the original sun standing in the sky is self-manifested. Similarly, the Supreme Soul, the original cause of all entities, who is thus separate from all of them, acts by the illumination of his own transcendental experience as the ultimate source of manifestation of all mutually manifesting objects. Now, don't worry, we're going to be explaining this. But let's read the verses first. And now text 32. Similarly, the sense organs, namely the skin, ears, eyes, tongue, and nose, as well as the functions of the subtle body, namely conditioned consciousness, mind, intelligence, and false ego, can all be analyzed in terms of the threefold distinction of sense, object of perception, and presiding deity. So, now what this means is that to perceive anything requires the intersection, the coming together of three factors. One factor is the seer, the adhyatmika self, the one who has the power to see. Another factor is the object that is seen, the object out there in the world, which is called adibhuta. The third factor, adidaiva, is the demigod of sight, who is the sun. And the sun is said to be the eye of the Vishvarupa, the eye of the universal form. That eye is an archetype. I think many of you know this word, archetype. Archetype means the basic form of a thing from which all other things get the form. Just like the sun being the eye of the universal form, that round, bright object in the sky is the archetype of our eyes, the eyes of all living beings. It's no coincidence that the sun is round and this eye is round. It's no coincidence that the sun gives light, and only by that light is it possible for this eye to see. It's no coincidence. This is the plan of Krishna. So the Surya, demigod of the sun, is also the demigod of our sight. Actually, he expands into these eyes. Right? And all demigods They have expanded into the bodies of living entities, and they are controlling the functions of the senses. So these three factors, the seer himself, the living entity, the objects that are seen, and the demigods that control the functions of the senses, these must intersect in this body to produce perception. Now, as we've heard, all of this is going on against the background of the Supreme Consciousness of Sri Vishnu, the Super Soul. This is all made possible. It all works together because of Paramatma, Super Soul. So the background of our perception is actually the Supreme Perception of Krishna Himself. So, therefore, let me give one example first to make this a little more clear. If you can imagine a lamp which gives light, and then there is light, and then there is a color wheel with red, blue, and yellow. These are the three primary colors, each of which represents one of the modes of nature. Yellow symbolizes goodness, red passion, and blue ignorance. Now, a hot lamp, there's actually such a device. A hot lamp is set up with a wheel, and just the heat and light of the lamp itself causes the wheel to turn, because the lamp is producing so much energy, so that beam of light will cause the lamp to rotate. So when the colors, these primary colors, rotate with a light shining through them, the colors mix and they produce all other colors. All other colors that we see are a combination of yellow, red, and blue. Just like all varieties of experience that we have in this material world are the result of the interaction of the three modes of nature on our consciousness. The light, in this example, represents our consciousness, the consciousness of the jiva. The color wheel represents the three modes of nature. And the colors that are produced are, of course, all the forms and varieties of this material world. So the lamp, the source of the light, the source of the consciousness, and the source of the energy that turns the color wheel, that is the Paramatma. Everyone understand this example? Can I see some nodding heads? No? Yes? Does everyone have a picture of this example in their mind? It's very simple. They use this machine in America to light up artificial Christmas trees, this type of lamp. They get a Christmas tree that's artificial, made of silver foil, and they put a lamp to shine on it through a color wheel, and thus the Christmas tree seems to change colors in the window, all different kinds of colors. So, it is because of the Supreme Lord who is emanating the jiva and simultaneously giving the power for the movement of the modes of material nature, because He is at the background, that therefore we are able to perceive the form and variety of this material world. So, therefore, now from Canto 11, Chapter 22, Text 34, we learn that the speculative argument of philosophers that this world is real, no, it is not real, is based upon incomplete knowledge of the Supreme Soul and is simply aimed at understanding material dualities. Although such argument is useless, persons who have turned their attention away from Me, their own true self, are unable to give it up. Now from the purport. The material world is real, specifically because it emanates from the Supreme Reality, Lord Krishna. Without understanding the reality of Lord Krishna, one can never definitely ascertain the reality of his creation. One will always wonder if he is actually seeing something or merely thinking that he is seeing. This kind of speculation can never be resolved without taking shelter of the Supreme Lord and is therefore useless. So these speculative philosophers, whether Buddhist or Mayavadi or anybody else, any materialistic philosopher, they do not understand Vishnu, Paramatma. They have no conception. So therefore, they're left speculating with the different ingredients of perception, their own consciousness, the power of sight, and the object that is seen. And they're trying to sort it out. You see? They're trying to understand what is myself as opposed to what I am seeing. Is there any difference? Some will say, yes, there is a difference. Some will say, no, there is no difference. I am what I see. And in this way, in that way, they argue without end. There is no end. Because there is no basis in fact. The basis in fact, or the basis of reality, is Krishna himself. But they have excluded the Sat, as we've explained previously. Just for those who are new, because today it seems we have some new listeners. We've already explained in previous session the term Sat, which you may know means real. So Sat means Krishna, the Supreme Reality, but Sat also means this manifest world too, which comes from Krishna. But if one separates this world from Krishna by atheism, by speculation, then one cannot actually understand this world anymore. Just like Hare Kesha Maharaj was saying in the lecture today, without Krishna consciousness, one becomes bewildered. One becomes overwhelmed by the influence of material nature. This is what happens. So philosophers are likewise bewildered. And they simply argue among themselves. The world is real. And others say, no, the world is unreal. And they argue back and forth and fill so many volumes of books down through the centuries. But Bhagavatam says this is all useless. They'll never reach an end. Because they have actually excluded the Supreme Reality who is at the background. So now, let us find out what is illusion. We've explained what Bhagavatam says about perception. Now let us find out what Bhagavatam says is illusion. This is very important. Because again, the Buddhists and others, the Mayavadis too, they say that everything is illusion. Everything that you see, or everything that you experience, it is essentially illusion. There is no reality anywhere. It is just a fantasy, a dream. So what does Bhagavatam say? Now, interestingly enough, actually we've touched on this previously, but now we're going to focus on it. Bhagavatam also says, from 4th Canto, chapter 29, Text 2b. Now you may wonder, what kind of verse is this? Text 2b. This is a verse which appears only in some editions of the Srimad Bhagavatam. It's been included by Srila Prabhupada. It's an optional verse, you might say. But it's a very, very interesting verse. I like this verse very much. Adrishtam dushtavan nakshet Bhutam Swapnavad Anyata Bhutam Bhavat Bhavishyat Cha Suptam Sava Roho Raha, which means everything happening within time, which consists of past, present, and future, is merely a dream. That is the secret understanding in all Vedic literature. So here we hear that the Vedic scriptures tell us everything is a dream. So does that mean the Buddhists are right? The Mayavadis are right? So let us see what that, let us see further. Look further at this Bhagavatam explanation that everything is like a dream. So Canto 6, Chapter 16, verses 53 and 54. When a person is in deep sleep, he dreams and sees in himself many other objects, such as great mountains and rivers, or perhaps even the entire universe, although they are far away. Sometimes when one awakens from a dream, he sees that he is in a human form, lying in his bed in one place. Then he sees himself in terms of various conditions, as belonging to a particular nationality, family, and so on. All the conditions of deep sleep, dreaming, and wakefulness are but the energies of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. One should always remember the original creator of these conditions, the Supreme Lord, who is unaffected by them. So this is what is important. We've mentioned this before. That yes, the world is like a dream. This is the secret understanding of the Vedic scriptures. But whose dream? That's the question. So here we've heard that the dream energy is also the energy of the Supreme Lord. So this world is a dream, but it's a dream of Vishnu, of Mahavishnu. Therefore, the world is not the way we would like it to be. Because if the world was our dream, you see, and there's someone I don't like in my dream, some bad man who comes and harasses me, then if it is really my dream, I should be able to say, you don't exist anymore. Get out. Get off of my cloud, as some old song said. Get out of my dream. But the world doesn't work that way. You see, we are forced to have unpleasant dreams. We are forced to experience a life which does not go the way we like. So it is actually not our dream. It is the Lord's dream. So let us hear the purport to this verse we've just read. As living entities, we are being carried away by the waves of Prakriti or nature, which works under the Lord's direction. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, Miche Mayar Vasi Jacho Beshi Kachuhu Dubu Bhai. Why are you being carried away by the waves of the illusory energy in various phases of dreaming and wakefulness? These are all creations of Maya. Our only duty is to remember the supreme director of this illusory energy, Krishna. For us to do this, the Shastra advises, Harinam, Harinam, Harinam Eva Kevalam. One should constantly chant the holy name of the Lord, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So there are some further verses I'll refer you to. I won't read them, but I'll explain them. But I'll tell you that these are verses 27 and 28 from Canto 11, Chapter 13, which explains that wakefulness, which is called Jagrata in Sanskrit, and Svapna, which is the dream state, and Sushupti, which is deep sleep. These are the effects of the modes of material nature on consciousness. You see? Consciousness is again pure, like clear light. But when light shines through a color wheel, a turning color wheel, then sometimes it looks yellow, sometimes it looks red, and sometimes it looks blue. So these different states of conditioned consciousness, they are wakefulness, mode of goodness, dreaming, mode of passion, and deep sleep, mode of ignorance. So, now what does this mean, that the mode of passion is dreaming? You see, this is how we can understand that material life is a dream. Because mostly everyone is in the states of passion and ignorance. This world, especially in Kali Yuga, one sees that practically 99% of the human population are under the influence of the modes of passion and the modes of ignorance. So passion means activity. So that means all of their activity is more or less like a dream. It's a product of the mode of passion. It's a dream. So all of their values, which are produced out of the mode of passion, like for instance, the goal of life is to pursue money and sense gratification, and we should all pair off man and woman and enjoy life, enjoy sex life together, and such and such is a very nice movie star, and such and such Picasso is a very nice painter, and all, anyway, we could just go on and on with so many examples of materialistic values. These are all just dreams. Exactly dreams. They have no factual reality in them. How do we know they're like dreams? Because, again, as Hari Kesh Maharaj was saying in his lecture, this life of the mode of passion is very dangerous. So someone may die in the midst of all of his pursuits, pursuing to enjoy these so-called values. So he suddenly dies, he suddenly drops dead. Then what is the meaning of all this nonsense? You see, when he was alive, you could have come and done an interview. You see, what is the most important thing in life? Oh, it's making money. Money is everything. And what is the greatest pleasure in life? Oh, sex life. Sex is so nice. And so on and so forth. What kind of music do you like? I like rock and roll. Who's your favorite actor? Arnold Schwarzenegger. So on and so forth. So all of these things, he thinks these are reality. This is most important. But when he's dying, when his heart is palpitating, and his breath, he's losing his breath, and his vision is dimming, and he feels his subtle body leaving the gross body for good, then what does all this mean? It was like a dream. Exactly like a dream. Meaningless. Having no real substance. So that is passionate life. It's like a big dream. And ignorance means sushupti. Total unawareness. Like the ignorant creatures, the trees, the animals. They're not even aware of these dreamlike values of the materialistic karmis. So they're in ignorance. And sometimes also the materialistic karmis, the persons in the mode of passion, they become so frustrated that they take total shelter of the mode of ignorance. They give it up. They give up their pursuit of wealth and fame and sense gratification, and they just become alcoholics, for instance. That's very common. They just take to the bottle, drinking and remaining in a complete drunken stupor. This is tamoguna. So, what is wakefulness then? Wakefulness means a man in the mode of goodness, not necessarily a devotee. But a man in the mode of goodness, he knows he's not the body. And he knows that this passionate life is a dream. He doesn't identify with it. He's aloof from it. But a man in the mode of goodness, material mode of goodness, although he's awake, he's like a man who's still in bed. You see? Still in the bed of material nature. Sometimes at night, you know, I find here in Mayapur that I'm always waking up at 12:30. So I've started now just getting up at 12:30 and chanting some rounds. Then I go back to bed at about 2. Because I just find, I just wake up and I look at the watch and it's 12:30. So anyway, this happens, I think, to most people. You're asleep, it's time to take rest, you're sleeping, and you're dreaming, and suddenly you wake up and you look at the clock and it's 12:30 or something like that, some strange hour. Not time to get up. So you're you're awake, but you're laying in bed. So what will happen? Or you'll go back to sleep. The only way to make sure that you don't go back to sleep is to get up. Get up, and take bath, and become engaged in physical activities. So this getting up, that's been explained already. We heard in the purport. This getting up out of even the material mode of goodness means to engage in spiritual activities. To chant, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. And to engage all the senses in the service of Krishna. Now this is what it means when we hear that a devotee is above the influence of the modes of material nature. Yes, he is, because he's engaged in spiritual activities. Whereas a materialistic person, he may be in the mode of goodness, so that he knows, I'm not the body, and he knows that these passionate affairs that one sees in New York and Los Angeles and Paris and London, the big passionate centers of the world, he knows this is all nonsense. But he has no alternative. Just like there are so many thoughtful, well, maybe not so many, but there are some thoughtful persons, poets and speculators who write thoughtful philosophical books, and they lament how sad and cruel the world is, how people are running here and there, and they have no time to contemplate about deeper things. Life is so superficial. So they lament like that in their poetry and in their writings. But they themselves are also not free from materialistic activities. They also get caught up. You see, Mr. Poet, he sees a beautiful woman who likes his poetry. And immediately, then he's in a dream too. He thinks, oh, this is a nice woman. She loves me. She likes my poetry. So I should give her some money. I should take care of her. So he has to work. So then he also adopts the same dream values. So real freedom from this means to wake up, get up, jeev jago, jeev jago. Go to Chandra Bole. Lord Chaitanya is calling throughout the whole world. You sleeping living entities, you've been sleeping too long in the lap of the witch Maya. Now wake up and chant Hare Krishna and engage in positive spiritual activities. So this, anyway, we're coming back to the point of what is illusion. What is illusion? So there are these three modes of material nature working in this world. And our consciousness is being projected through them. So if we take this interaction of our consciousness with the three modes of nature to be real, then we are in illusion. So how can we detach our consciousness from the three modes of material nature? By going back to the source. Our consciousness is like light, and the light is coming from the lamp, or the super soul, the shelter of the jiva. So light belongs to light, soul belongs to super soul. So our shelter should be in Krishna, and while we're in this world, then because these three modes of nature, that is Krishna's energy, we can use Krishna's energy in His service. And we will not be influenced by the three modes due to always remembering Krishna. So now, we want to turn to the last subject today, which also comes under the heading of illusion. But this is, we want to look at the Srimad Bhagavatam's refutation of the doctrine of Sunyavada, voidism, which, as you can see here, it's a Buddhist doctrine, but this idea of voidism is not limited to Buddhism only, certainly not. There are voidists everywhere. As we explained day before yesterday, this voidist philosophy is simply a product of frustration, frustrated psychology. So it is seen in the West. In the West, it is known, they've given the term nihilism or nihilism. That there's no value in anything. Everything is just useless, zero. So in the Buddhist Shunyavad logic, they say that cause is destroyed by effect. Cause being the source, effect being the product of the source. So as soon as a effect emanates from a cause, the cause is destroyed. The cause ceases to exist. So as an example, looking at the cause of this body, this human body we have, the sperm from the father unites with the egg from the mother. So these two things cease to exist. And then there's the embryo. And the embryo develops until a baby is born. When the baby is born, the effect, then the cause, the embryo, ceases to exist. When the baby grows and becomes a youth, then the baby has ceased to exist. When the youth grows further and becomes an adult, then the youth ceases to exist. When the adult becomes an old person, then the adult has ceased to exist. This is how the Buddhists look at causation. So therefore, their conclusion is that there is no chain of cause and effect. You cannot really speak of cause. Where is that cause? It's gone. So, in other words, there's no point in looking for any cause. We have said on our first day of this seminar that philosophy means to seek out the cause. But the Sunyavadis say, what's the use of that? The cause is gone. If you want to search out the cause of this world, it's gone. You won't find it. Just like if you want to search out the cause of your body, it's gone. You won't find it. This is their idea. So therefore, the chain of cause and effect, it is just illusion. Therefore, there's no point in thinking about it. There's no use in understanding the world in terms of cause and effect. So what should we understand? Just void. Just nothingness. So from this Shunyavadi philosophy has come out this very popular form of Buddhism called Zen Buddhism. The goal of Zen, they say themselves, is no mind. You see, no more mind, no thinking anymore. Putting no value on anything, not understanding any cause and effect, any logical chain of events in the world. Everything is just the way it is. Don't impose any meaning on it. It just is. And what is that? It is void. It is nothing. These Zen Buddhists, they just go through life looking at everything and thinking, it is nothing. It is zero. It has no meaning. And that they consider to be enlightenment. But Bhagavatam refutes voidism in this way. Nice verse from Canto 7, Chapter 15, Text 58. Abhadito pihi abhaso yata vastutaya smritaha durgatatvad aindrikyakam tadvadarta vikalpitam. Although one may consider the reflection of the sun from a mirror to be false, It has its factual existence. Accordingly, to prove by speculative knowledge that there is no reality would be extremely difficult. So Srila Prabhupada's purport states, speculative knowledge cannot give us reality as it is, but will continue to be nefariously imperfect. So-called scientists try to prove that there is no God and that everything is happening because of the laws of nature. But this is imperfect knowledge because nothing can work unless directed by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This is explained in Bhagavad Gita 9.10 by the Lord Himself. This material nature is working under my direction, O Son of Kunti, and it is producing all moving and unmoving beings by its rule. This manifestation is created and annihilated again and again. So once Srila Prabhupada was walking with some devotees in Stockholm, and the sun, this was early in the morning, so the sun rose from behind Srila Prabhupada and the devotees, and the sun was reflected in the windows of some buildings before them. So the blinding sun then was shining in the eyes of Srila Prabhupada and the devotees. And Srila Prabhupada said, this is Maya. This is the example of Maya. That actually the sun is here, but due to illusion we think the sunlight is coming from there. So this verse we've just heard states that although one may consider the reflection of the sun from a mirror to be false, it has its factual existence. Why is that? Because the sun is there behind us. Therefore, there is light there in front of us. Now, if you take a stone, this is the Buddhist process. I will now explain Buddhist meditation, what it really means. It means to take a stone and to smash the glass. Ah, see, now it's gone. There is no light. That was all illusion. It's zero. There's nothing. No, the sun is still there. The actual source of that light is still there behind you. You may not be seeing because you're ignorant of it, but you have not destroyed it by smashing the glass. So the Shunyavada philosophy tries to negate this world by saying it is all an illusion. But as we've already heard previously, because this world emanates from the real, therefore it is also real but temporary. So we can say that the world is temporary and therefore we should not be attached to it. But we cannot say that the world in itself is unreal. So again, this Buddhist philosophy or all materialistic philosophies, it is the result of attachment. This is a philosophy of attachment, the philosophy of egoism, the philosophy of thinking myself to be the center of everything and yet becoming frustrated. You see, they want to be the center, they want to be God, they want to be the supremely conscious being, but they're frustrated, so therefore they concoct this ideology of nothingness, of Shunyavad. So I'm going to stop here. Tomorrow, our last session, we shall be speaking on liberation. The path of liberation, as explained in Srimad Bhagavatam. And I'm sure you'll find this very interesting, because this Vedantic explanation of liberation, once you understand it, it will make many, many things clear to you in the Vedic scriptures, in Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, and other Vedic scriptures. So we shall be looking at some certain verses from Srimad Bhagavatam that will help us understand this path, the path of spiritual progress, which takes the soul beyond the heavenly planets, beyond the Brahmaloka, beyond the Brahmajyoti, beyond the sense of oneness, and into the personal association of Krishna. Are there any questions? Yes?
What happens in the stage of deep sleep?
What happens in the stage of deep sleep? Yes. In the stage of deep sleep, the soul in the heart merges into the tamasic energy of the Paramatma, Super Soul. Just like when we merge, as we explained the other day, at the time of devastation of the whole universe, the living entities with the dissolved material elements merge into the body of Mahavishnu, and they repose there within the pradhan, the potential material energy, which is within Lord Mahavishnu's body. So similarly, when we go to sleep at night, for about half an hour every night, we experience a very, microcosmic devastation, in which our consciousness merges into Paramatma, into his tamasic feature. And we experience that as dreamless sleep.
Is that also the goal of the Buddhists?
Yes, that is a, yes. The Buddhists, this is what they attain. The pradhan. They merge into the unmanifest material elements.
How consciousness
is polluted, not just these looks, because Prabhupada explained the beauty of Santa with prayer and dust. Yes. Yes, so what is polluted is our understanding. Avritam jnanam etena jnaninas nityavairanam. The soul is the knower. He's full of knowledge. But his knowledge, his understanding has become covered. So that example of air and dust, the air never mix, or the dust never mixes with the air, the sky never becomes cloudy. But due to wrong perception or wrong understanding, we see like that. We think like that. The fact remains as it is, always. So similarly with consciousness, the fact remains that our consciousness is pure. But due to the influence, due to association with Maya, then we're perceiving things wrongly, that's all. It's like this. It's like when you go to... don't do this, but if you know, people go to cinema house. They go inside and they sit down in the seat. Then the lights go down and a film is projected on the screen. Now all that's happening is that there's some light and color being shot onto the screen, and from some speakers some sound is coming. And there's a bunch of people sitting in a dark room looking at that. That's all. That's the reality. And that is the reality. But due to the understanding becoming covered, avritam, one looks at this film and thinks it's real. He allows his consciousness to become absorbed in it, and he's identifying, just like in every film, there's hero and heroine. There's the male leading figure and the female leading figure. So in the audience, the men identify with the man, and the ladies identify with the heroine. And so they actually start to experience, when there's some adventure in the film, they get excited, you see. And when there's some romance, then their hearts get very soft. And when there's danger, they become fearful. So these emotions are created in the audience. They're experiencing them. But all that's really going on is nothing but light and sound and some colors moving and some sound coming from speakers. And if in the middle of the film the lights suddenly come on, then the whole dream is broken. And you'll see when that happens, then the audience becomes very disturbed. Hey, turn down the lights. They want this illusion. We want to be in Maya. So material world is like that. Yes?
As Vaishnavas, do we accept material happiness as real?
No, material happiness and material distress are dualities of the mind. Sukha dukha da. Aga pavayano nityas tam tatikshashvata bharata. Krishna says that these are like the passing of summer and winter seasons. So in the winter time, when it's very cold, I think about the summer. I think, oh, look at all this horrible snow. I can't wait for the summertime to come, all the snow will be gone, everything will be green, and it'll be so nice. Then when the summertime comes, I think, oh, it's so hot. I'm burning up, boy. I wish I could go skiing down the snowy slopes. So we yearn for winter. So these are just dualities. And Prabhupada gave the example of carrying a load, you know. You carry a load on this shoulder for some time, and that shoulder becomes very painful. And then you switch the load to this shoulder. That shoulder feels relieved. Oh, very nice. And then, but gradually this shoulder becomes painful.
Therefore it's temporary, but it's still real, it's not false.
No, it's not real. It's not real because the spirit soul has nothing to do with this.
But the soul, because the soul is identifying with the body, it does. The soul thinks it's experiencing.
Yeah, but that's the dream being referred to. That's life in the mode of passion. Man in the mode of goodness, he's detached from all that. That's what Krishna is saying. Tam titikshasha bharata. You just have to tolerate these things. You may be perceiving heat, cold, happiness, distress, all that, but you should be apart from that. You should not let it bewilder you. You should not let it carry you away. So one who is actually in that state is Stitadhir Muni. He sees happiness and distress as the same, Krishna says. It's just some tingling of the nerve endings, just some, you know, some, just our sensory interaction with material nature. He puts no value on it. Just like Krishna says, gold, pebbles and stones, he sees as the same, just lumps of matter.
We just read that verse in the Bhagavatam, and also when Hiranyakashipu is instructing Mother Diti in the seventh canto, he's saying that material nature, it's real.
Yes.
It's a principle, but it's false in the sense that it's temporary.
Yes, but remember my example of the cinema house. There is a projector, there is a screen. There is something being projected onto the screen. There are speakers giving sound. There are people sitting in a dark room. That's what's real. But they're looking at the film and becoming absorbed in the movie and thinking, I'm Arnold Schwarzenegger, or I'm Madonna, or whoever it is up there. That's Maya. That's a dream. That's not real. And when Arnold gets hit in the face, we go, ooh! You
that
see?
Identification with
that identification.
With the real material world, that is...
Well, you see, the material world works to bewilder us. It's the illusory energy. So as soon as we begin to identify, then it's like this film, you know. There's something happening out there, which is Krishna's energy working. But when we start to identify it, then that which we perceive, that's not real anymore. That's how Maya works on our consciousness. Tejo varam mirdam yata vinimayo yatra trisago mirsha. In the first verse of Srimad Bhagavatam, there's this example of fire on water and water on land. So fire and water and land are real. But Maya bewilders us in this example is given. Just like if you see fire on water, as when the sun is going down, or the sun is going down on the ocean side, over the horizon. So it makes it look like there is fire in the sea. So there is a sun which is fiery, and there is an ocean which is watery, but there is no fire on the water. And similarly, if we see a mirage of water on land, there is water and there is land, but there is no water on land out there, or land on water, on the converse. So you see, this is how, as soon as we begin to identify, that means as soon as we want to control and exploit matter, then she works this illusion, this maya on us, and we become bewildered. But there is, yes, there is a real material nature out there, that is Krishna's energy. One in the mode of goodness, at least, he begins to see that reality. Because he's not caught up in that illusion, that passionate illusion of I am the controller, I am the enjoyer. And one who is Krishna's devotee, he sees the reality in full. Because he sees that this is Krishna's energy and it is meant to be used in Krishna's service. One in the mode of goodness sees that the illusion of this material world that is pursued after by materialists is not real. But he doesn't understand how to engage the material nature in Krishna's service. So therefore he's always subject, like I say, it's like a man still in bed who's awake, but if he stays in bed, he's going to fall back asleep at any time. So it's the devotee alone who knows that this is Krishna's energy and I must use it in Krishna's service. Krishna Sambandha Vigyana, in that prayer to Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati. It is a science, a great science. Krishna Sambandha Vigyana means science. To see how everything is connected to Krishna. This is the science of devotional service. This is what we have to learn from our spiritual master. There are foodstuffs. So how do we connect them with Krishna's service? You prepare these foodstuffs in a certain way, according to authorized Vedic recipes, and you offer the foodstuffs. In this way, you chant these mantras. You offer them to the deity, this particular deity, not Kali, Durga, Kala, Bhairava, but Radha and Krishna, Sri Sri Gornitai, Lord Jagannath, Baladev, Subhadra Devi. And in this way, Krishna Sambandha Vigyana, then this substance, this food, will become connected to Krishna as prasadam. And then you can take, and then that's not maya. That is spiritual life. Yes, Mataji, in the back. Yes, they may say that. But by saying that, then they cut themselves off from happiness, from spiritual happiness. Because Krishna is the Anandamaya Purusha. He is the Purusha. Purusha means soul, or also means person. Anandamaya, who is full of bliss. And he comes, he descends into this world to reveal his blissful pastimes, to reveal his blissful holy name, form, quality, activities. So that the living entities who are simply pursuing this maya sukha, this illusory happiness, will know what is real happiness and can take it up through devotional service. So by the mayavadi saying, oh, that, because they have this cow philosophy actually. Prabhupada once said it's cow philosophy. Giving the example of a cow that was caught in a barn that was on fire. So this cow saw the blazing orange and yellow sheets of flame and became very frightened. And then last moment, the cow was saved. But whenever the cow in the future would see sheets of yellow and orange, it would become frightened and run away, making a loud sound. So when the farmer's wife would hang out the yellow and orange curtains or bed sheets in the wash on the line, and if the cow was eating grass there, and the cow would see these sheets, yellow and red sheets, fluttering in the wind, it would run away. So this is actually, this Mayavadi philosophy is just cow philosophy. So, the Mayavadis have had bad experience with form and activity and enjoyment. So when they hear from the Vaishnavas that there is spiritual form, spiritual activity, spiritual enjoyment, they foolishly reject it. And thus their attempt at renunciation, because Mayavadis, in order to get free of Maya, they try to renounce. That renunciation is called Shushka Vairagya. It is dry. Dry renunciation. Prabhupada said the Mayavadis, when they study Vedantas, they also study Vedanta according to Shankaracharya. So they take this as a duty. They have to turn the pages of Vedanta Sutra. Just this is their activity. So many hours a day, they have to turn the pages of Vedanta Sutra, reading and trying to understand how everything is illusion, everything is really Brahman. And that's their so-called spiritual life. Very dry. If a scorpion comes and stings them on the hand, they have to keep turning the pages. This is Shushka Vairagya. Yes?
You've mentioned how some Buddhists choose Brahman, and also in the second day you say that the Sankhya followers also only get Pradhan, no further. So what is with the Mayavadis? They also go at this stage, or they can go
from this stage? The Mayavadis, they're two kinds of impersonalists who seek out the Atman. There are the Mayavadis and the Brahmavadis. So the Mayavadis are offenders. Mayavadi Krishna hi aparadhi, Lord Chaitanya said. They offend Krishna because they have this dogma, this doctrine, that the personality of Godhead is a product of illusion, product of Maya. So, they're offensive. So because of that, they may attain Brahman, but it is a kind of punishment. They're flung into the rays of Brahma Jyoti. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, for instance, if a Mayavadi chants the Hare Krishna mantra, because the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra is Krishna himself, none different. Therefore, but he's chanting without any real love of Krishna. He's chanting in this offensive idea that God has no form. Therefore, the result of his chanting is that he is thrown into the impersonal Brahma Jyoti. And Srila Prabodhananda Saraswati said, Kaivalya Narakayate, that this state of being one with the impersonal Brahman is like going to hell for the living entity, because there's no engagement there. So he becomes dissatisfied in that state, and later on he'll be attracted to Maya again, because he has to do something. He has desires which cannot be fulfilled there. So he'll fall back down into the material world. The Brahmavadis, on the other hand, do not have this doctrine that Krishna's name, form, qualities are Maya. It's just that they have ascended by way of a slow process, which we'll actually describe tomorrow in our discussion of the path of liberation. It's called the Brahmapanta, the path to Brahman. It is a path followed by yogis. And so they attain the Brahma Jyoti. And by association of devotees, they may progress further. Like Bhagavatam says in the Atmarama verse, Atmarama cha muneo nirgranta pi urukrame. That verse says that one may be Atmarama, situated in the self, in the Atman, Atmarama, enjoying the liberated state of the self. the neutral state or Brahman state. But if he hears about Krishna, he'll be attracted, and thus his devotional life will begin. The Mayavadis, they can't hear about Krishna, because they have this dogma. As soon as they hear about Krishna, they reject. Oh, this is more Maya. And they avoid it. So therefore, Mayavadi means, as Prabhupada said, one who remains in Maya, one who sticks to Maya, Prabhupada once said. They actually never get free of Maya. They condemn themselves to fall down again. Yes?
Mahaprabhu and Ramananda Rai, that the Dhyana Yogi, they go no further than the Viraj Yoga.
Yes.
They stay in the material world. So that seems that there is no something like Viraj and Brahmacharya. This is the Pradhan is so also described as Brahman, similar to Brahman. So it seems that everything who say that to merge in Brahmacharya is meant to merge with Pradhan, is right?
The Brahmacharya is a marginal position. So one cannot remain fixed. One has to go one way or the other way. So one can make spiritual progress after having attained the Brahman conception, Brahma Bhuta Prasanatma Nasoshati Nakankshati. That verse confirms that from the Brahma Bhuta platform, Mad Bhaktim Labhate Param, there pure devotional service begins when one has transcended the body. Or if one doesn't do that, if one doesn't accept Krishna consciousness, then from that marginal position, one will gradually, imperceptibly become covered over by the material nature again. So that, you see, that jyoti is shining from Mahavishnu. It's becoming immediately conditioned, or let us say it is enshrined. That's the word that's used in Brahma Sanghita. That jyoti, which consists of the jivas, they're immediately enshrined by the Shambhu Tattva, which is Lord Shiva. He becomes the container of all these jivas. As soon as they leave Mahavishnu, he encapsulates them, and then he directs them into the material energy, or impregnates them into the material energy, the pradhan, which is, he is the husband of Durga. So that position of in Brahman, you see, it's, as I say, it's just borderline. You either take shelter of Vishnu, or you become encapsulated in Shambhu Tattva and end up again in the material nature. It's not a fixed position. That's what the Prabhupada said. They're always coming and going. That's what the meaning of Brahma Jyoti, coming and going. Jivas who are coming and going. Either going back to Godhead or coming here. Yes?
My question is in connection with difference between the matter and spirit. Once one devotee asked Prabhupada, and Prabhupada gave example of like rose. And Prabhupada explained the rose is rose. If we are take rose for our...
Rose, you mean flower?
Yes. Yeah. If we take flower for our own enjoying, that it is matter. But if we offer to Krishna,
spirit.
I am always thinking when we offer food to Krishna, there's some transformation going on. But it seems that also in our consciousness some transformation is going on.
Yes. Brahmarpanam, Brahma Havir, Brahmagnao, Brahmana Hutam, Brahmaivatena Gantavya, Brahma Karma Samadina. That is all explained in the Bhagavad Gita, 4th chapter. That in Jagya, in offering to the Lord, the thing that is offered, the person who is offering, and the act of offering itself, and also the consummation, the reception of the offering by the Supreme Lord, all of that is Brahman. All of that is happening on the transcendental platform. So, yes, indeed, that flower, that rose which is offered to Krishna, becomes a spiritual flower. Or Prabhupada would say, Krishnized, spiritualized. The example again of being iron in fire. The specific form of that rose will wilt away, but it's still not material. Why is it not material? Because the effect is spiritual. If you smell that rose, that act of smelling this rose is liberating. You've just purified your nose. You've just purified your mind. You've just purified your heart. You've just purified your consciousness by smelling that rose. If you smell an ordinary, unoffered rose, you become more attached to the material world.
It's connected with your example that when our consciousness is connected with the soul, then it is not influenced by the different gunas, and because it is pure.
Yes. Yes, exactly. That's a good understanding. Yes?
In that regard, couldn't you say that then us as devotees we're also practicing the same process of yogacara, in that our consciousness determines our perception, and that if I see that my consciousness is such that this is Krishna's energy, the rose's energy, then it becomes spiritual. And if my consciousness is material, it's permitted, then it becomes material.
Yeah, but there is a reference there. The reference is to Krishna's consciousness. In these atheistic philosophies, they have no ultimate reference. Reference is just you. The world is whatever you make out of it.
So independent of my consciousness, it remains Krishna's.
Yes.
Spiritual energy, where it will go.
Exactly. Therefore, I mentioned that verse from Bhagavatam, 4th canto, in which it says, Krishna consciousness means to see this universe exactly as the Supreme Lord sees it. So that, how does the Supreme Lord see this universe? As His energy. And He has His own plan for this energy. He reveals this plan when He comes. When Lord Krishna descends, then He actually shows the real use of everything in His Leela. That He's the enjoyer.
So actually everything is spiritual, but Maya acts on our consciousness, not on the actual object itself.
Yes. But you must understand, yes, Maya acts on our consciousness, but all these things that we see around us are also living beings with their consciousness. So Maya is acting on them too. It's not just us.
Right, right.
So simultaneously, you see, this is the intersection. Adi Daiva, Adi Bhuta, Adi Atma. It's all intersecting according to the plan of Krishna.
But actually, what I'm establishing is that the material nature, as like an absolute principle, regardless of my consciousness, is pure spirit.
Yes.
But
yes.
It's because of my consciousness.
Yeah. That she shows this.
That she's like putting a cataract before my eyes.
Exactly. Yes, that's the fact. What time is it now?
11.
Oh, 11:30. Oh, okay, not so late. Yes.
I was wondering why these self-realized souls, so-called self-realized souls, bodhisattvas, why they were preaching, if the ultimate teaching would be that everything is a creation of the mind, is just illusion, then these people they're preaching to must also just be illusion.
His question is, he was asking yesterday, or the day before yesterday, we mentioned about this Buddhist idea of bodhisattva, because just as an answer to some question. And he wants to know why they preach if the doctrine is everything is illusion anyway. Yeah, well, there's no answer to that question. I mean, that's a self-contradiction within Buddhism. Yes?
Sorry, coming back to that, then, in terms of the Mayavadis and the Buddhists, what happens to an object if they're not consciously present?
Huh?
If I leave a place and I'm not consciously observing an object, then what is the truth of that object?
Yeah, according to their philosophy, then it doesn't exist. It's not there.
If they walk out the room, then everything within that room just ceases to exist.
Yes. That's the Shunyavad philosophy, exactly. That actually everything is void. Everything is void, and this that I'm seeing is just some, just some dream, just some whatever it is. I shouldn't ascribe any value to it, because behind it there is just void. It's just like some annoyance, you know. Really, everything is void, but there's this annoying display of form and color in front of me. So I just shouldn't get into it. I should just ignore it. Just keep meditating on the nothingness that's beyond it. Yes? Yeah, well, fortunately for you, there is Krishna's mercy. Krishna's very merciful. So, we may not be on the platform of spiritual understanding, as you have said, but we enter the association of devotees and we partake in devotional activities, and that in itself is purifying. Now, this brings up a very nice point about internal spiritual life and external spiritual life. This is something that I think bothers most devotees, maybe always, or at least at some point in their progress in Krishna consciousness. They reach some problem with this. Sometimes they think of themselves as great hypocrites or whatever. They have a problem that externally I'm engaged in Krishna consciousness, but internally there are so many impurities. I have so many bad desires and memories and, you know, tendencies. And so what is my position? Am I really a devotee? Am I just a demon acting like a devotee? So this question came up in a conversation between Srila Prabhupada and a Catholic priest named Father Tanner in London in 1973. And so Father Tanner, on the basis of his own experience as a Catholic priest, you know, in the Catholic priesthood they have to follow celibacy, but so many priests, they fall down. They get involved in some scandalous behavior, or they leave the priesthood altogether, get married, or they have other problems, they become alcoholics. So this was a very important theme to Father Tanner. So he kept bringing this up again and again to Prabhupada, that a man may externally be doing the rituals and look pure, but how do we know he's pure inside? And so Srila Prabhupada, his answer again and again, because the priest was always bringing this up, so Prabhupada again and again, in so many ways, he was preaching to the priest that the process of Krishna consciousness is transcendental. Now of course the process of that the Catholic priest follows is something else. But this process of Krishna consciousness, of chanting Hare Krishna, serving the deity, that is completely spiritual. So if we place ourselves in these spiritual activities, because spiritual life is absolute, therefore we become externally pure and internally pure, as long as we are situated in the bona fide spiritual activities, following the regulative principles, chanting 16 rounds, serving the deity, using all of our time in Krishna's service. And Srila Prabhupada again gave this example of the iron and the fire. He said, you place the iron represents our materialistic self, materialistic consciousness, this body and the senses and the mind and so on. You place the iron in the fire are the spiritual activities. So now, where does the heat first act upon the iron? On the outside, of course. That's the part of the iron that starts to become hot first. But as long as the iron stays in the fire, then gradually the heat, very quickly, the heat penetrates to the very core. And the whole thing becomes red hot. So Srila Prabhupada said, he insisted to this priest, as long as these boys and girls are engaged in their duties, their Krishna conscious duties, then we must accept them as being both internally as well as externally pure. The criterion is simply whether or not they are properly engaged in their duties. There is no other criterion. Prabhupada, he would not, the priest was saying, but later on, couldn't they fall down? He gave the example of, say there's a man who's marooned on some desert island somewhere. So because he's alone on this desert island, there's no opportunity for him to drink liquor, there's no opportunity for him to have illicit sex. So then, okay, for the time he's on that island, he's pure. But as soon as he gets off, he goes back into the human society, immediately we see these activities again. So the priest was saying, couldn't it just be by circumstance that these boys and girls in ISKCON, they seem to be pure, but actually they will fall down? And Srila Prabhupada said, this is no consideration. He said, if their activities are pure now, we accept them as pure now. Of course, there's always that chance of falling down. Because we have free will. Free will is always there. But as long as one sticks to the process, one is pure. Prabhupada said, this is like if someone places a nice plate of prasadam in front of you. You don't think that, oh, in 3 hours, in 5 hours, this will be spoiled. So I better not eat it. No, now it's good. Now you take it. You see, don't speculate that it may be bad in the future, so I shouldn't take it. So this is the answer. Whatever is going on, whatever we find going on in our mind, in our heart now, as long as you stay engaged in devotional service, as directed by this bona fide spiritual master, then you are pure. You're purely situated. And these things, these dirty things that are in the heart, they will very quickly be washed away. The longer we stay in the process, the more purified we become. So these botherations from lingering impurities, you simply have to tolerate. But don't worry about them. You know, don't let them drag you down. Don't become morbidly obsessed, thinking, if I have such a thought as this, I must be a demon. So what's the use of me being in this movement? I'm so fallen. I should just leave. Because if you leave, then definitely you will fall down. Yes?
Using that example you're saying, and also how our consciousness determines our perception of things. It's true therefore that my consciousness will determine, for instance, how the holy name appears. If I'm chanting purely, then Krishna is actually present in his name. But if I'm chanting with offenses, then it's not. So, is that true? And then also, how do we make advancement in that regard? Because
well, Krishna, abhina van nama nami no. The holy name and the named, the one who is named, are abhina. They are not different. Of course, we're speaking of the name given by the pure devotee, the name that comes in this sampradaya. So one who is chanting that name, if one chants the name given by some Mayavadi, some nonsense, some sahajya, that won't even be Krishna's name at all. It doesn't matter what he does. He's not chanting Krishna's name. He's just chanting some mundane vibration that happens to coincide. You know, the syllables Krishna are there. But it hasn't been received from a pure devotee. But if one receives the sound from a pure devotee, that is Krishna's holy name. So